Before we start, this episode is brought to you by Solid Erections Carpentry. Whether it's a door hanging, a deck building, a full renovation, they do it all in a timely and an efficient manner, working to a budget within your guidelines. They complement the look of your home in a matter of weeks. Then check out the team at Solid Erections Carpentry, who are based in Brisbane.
Don't just talk it, walk it.
Walk is only.
Don't just talk it, walk it. Don't just talk it, walk it.
Walk is on.
Don't just talk it, walk it.
Walk is on.
Chet, how you doing, brother?
I'm good. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thanks, mate. First and foremost, thank you so much for jumping on. What can I say? I've heard a lot of good things about you from friends and obviously people in the performance space. So this is a great opportunity for me to kind of delve into. I've seen you about a part of the performance space, but more know about you as a person and what you do, because you do a lot of things actually, not just pigeonholed in one area. So do you want to give a little bit of a debrief on yourself? And
Sure thing. So it's quite difficult to describe it, because I think I go through these phases every 3 years. I kind of get bored of one thing, or I might just evolve that and move into something else. And it seems to be a recurring thing for the last, I would say, 10 years, where I stick to something obsessively. So it started off with weight training, and then it migrated into handstands, calisthenics. Mm. And then now it's gone down the flexibility, mobility route, which has gone from the typical goals of doing splits and bridges and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And now working with athletes with knee problems and ACL injuries and MCLs, all this kind of major performance related stuff. And I guess that's how this idea to move into the performance space came. But that's just one part of my life. If we're going to go all the way back, is that way?
Yeah, mate. Well, I'm curious on it all. We can talk about it on all stages, but as soon as you said ACLs, my brain popped, because I've actually had three knee reconstructions on the right knee.
Right.
And, they're long journeys, those ACL recos. And, I think, like you said, you started originally as a trainer, coach, and then getting more interested in the body and the anatomy of and whatnot. And the body's amazing, right? And it's crazy what it can endure.
Yeah.
And how it just constantly keeps turning up, regardless of the impact we put the body through.
Yeah, we'll start there then. We'll start with the body first, and then we'll move into the mind later on. But I think it is to do with your determination. And, a lot of people have different levels of tolerance when it comes to pain.
Yeah.
And some people, the smallest amount of discomfort, and it's usually how I term it when I usually go through a process of training someone, I try and teach them as a first lesson that whatever injury you're feeling in your body, is it actually pain, or would you say it's just a large amount of discomfort? Mm. And there's a very, very big difference between the two. So let's say if I was going to stab you with a knife, 100% you would say that's pain, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The sharp sensation you get in the body. If you ever been stabbed by a pin or you stood on a pin, you know exactly what pain is, or if you touch fire. But this form of injury, when we talk about tendons and ligaments, it is pain to a certain degree. But after a while, if you actually pay attention to it, you start to realize, especially when you're going through the rehab process, that it's not necessarily pain anymore. It's just a large amount of discomfort. And the body will have a certain level of apprehension towards that. So if I put you on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being no sensation whatsoever, 10 being excruciatingly painful, you would probably sit on about 7 or 8 if you've just come out fresh from the injury.
Of course.
And then, if you do something a bit too crazy with that injury, it might push up to a 9, but it rarely ever gets to a 10. When it gets to a 10, you know straight away, I'm not ready for it. Now, what I'm there to do as my job is for you to understand where you are on that scale. Mm. I've just had someone, funnily enough, who had she had golfer's elbow and she also had tennis elbow at the same time. Mm. So she had golfer's elbow first, made it worse. Then she went bowling, had her arm straight, and then she got tennis elbow from that. So I was trying to teach her that even though we're training and you're feeling discomfort, as long as that discomfort doesn't cross over, I would say about 8, it can cross over here and there for a split second, maybe a few seconds. But if it doesn't cross over for too long, you're pretty much recovering. The body is still recovering. The only thing you're not doing is providing it enough stimulus. This is why you're coming to me, so we're providing it enough stimulus. She didn't buy into it. So she, credit to her, she trusted what I was doing. I said to her, stick with me for 3 months with what we're doing right now, and I guarantee you it'll make a difference. And now she's feeling a lot better. She actually injured herself again, not in the elbow. Not in the elbow. It was a wrist injury, but it did impact back into the elbow.
Wow.
But she got that sensation of it increasing to an 8 or a 9 again. It went down to about a 5 or a 6.
Wow.
And then now she said, look, I'm still confident with it. Even though it's gone to that level, I know that in a week's time, it'll probably come down again and we're back to normal again.
Wow.
So yeah, it's understanding the body. And I think from what we're talking about, I don't think in the medical field, not just at this level that we're at, I'm talking about right at the top, I don't think they fully understand injuries to the level we want them to understand them. As an athlete, you turn to someone, a physio or a doctor, and you want them to tell you, this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to happen, and this is how we're going to get better. But it doesn't seem to happen. And I've worked with that kind of person where I've seen the same sort of results. And I'm rambling a bit.
I love this. This is interesting. This is great, Chet.
Yeah, you've caught me right at the right moment where I'm talking passionately about what I enjoy.
Amazing.
A long time ago, I was seeing this girl who was Welsh national champion. Don't know if she's listened to the podcast, but if she is, a shout out to her.
Welsh national.
She was Welsh national champion for the 1500 meter, and I think it was 800 meter. This was back in 2016, I want to say. And she was in the Northwest. She was training there for 6 months in Wigan, of all places. And She was from Cardiff, and she was going to go back to.
It's not my cousin now or something, is it?
We'll have to talk after the camera stopped rolling in case. I wasn't really properly seeing her. I was just, talking to her here and there. And on the day that we were supposed to go on our first date, she passed out on track. So she was doing a trial for the Olympics, and she came, I think she said she came a tenth of a second slow for the qualifying time. And bear in mind, this woman was burnt out. And she told me a story, what she'd gone through. And I'm like, I'm surprised your body's still surviving. But this is the intensity that these athletes train at to get into the Olympics. So I was just going through the process of seeing how she trains. And I remember we were sat down in a living room, and I just looked at her hips, and she was sat down cross-legged, and her knees were all the way up here. I don't know if the cameras are showing this, but the knees were really high. And I said, is that your maximum range? And she goes, yeah. I said, what are your coaches working on with? Bear in mind, she's paying it out of her own pocket. A lot of money for these world-class coaches. And I said, are they not working on your hips or any of the bigger muscles? And she said, no, they're really working on the small, refined muscles, like how her gait is, how she's stepping off with a toe, etc. And I said, I guarantee you, if I had gotten to know you 6 months prior when you first came up to the Northwest, you would have been completely different to where you are right now. It's a shame that they're not really focusing on the larger muscles.
Of course.
But that thought didn't really... it didn't really faze me. It didn't really faze her. I only thought about this about 2 or 3 years ago when I was going down this path. And I started realizing it's absolutely insane how this athlete, she'd won a number of competitions in Wales. She's won world competitions as well. And yet the coaches that she was training with were only focusing on the way she was running and the smaller muscles in her toes. And I just thought, what's going on here? This doesn't make sense. And then as I went down this path, I met different athletes. I met gymnasts. Yeah. And you think in the gymnastics field, it would be more prioritized towards these larger muscles. And again, to a certain degree, yes. But the training process itself isn't catered towards efficiency of recovery and efficiency of muscle use. So what I mean by that is, if you're going to go from point A to point B, and we're judging the distance from point A to point B, I want to see what muscles are switching on. And it starts with the larger muscles first, and then I'll focus on the smaller muscles. But if your larger muscles are not doing the work, then your smaller muscles will have to do the work.
They're overworking then.
They're overworking, hence the ACL injury.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Well, this body's an interesting one. I actually had the way the surgeon explained it. So on my third knee reconstruction, I basically was playing rugby at the time, and I ran back to the line. And typically when you do an ACL, it's from change direction or pivot. But mine was actually, I turned around, got to the line, turned around, and I tried to take off, and it just went. But where the tibia and the fibia connect, as in the joint, on the knee joint, the last surgeon was amazing. He actually realized that the bottom bone, where it connects to the knee, wasn't actually like sitting flush. It was on like a 13-degree angle.
Right.
So it was actually pressuring it to come down. So what they did a break of the, it's the feet, the bone, these two bones. So you did the break down the on the bottom of the bone. Apologies for my description, but and they cut a wedge out of the bone, brought the knee down. So then it's sitting more flush. And since then, touch wood, we haven't had any issues with it. But to go through three knee reconstructions, couple of clean outs over the time, you know, and just to know that the body can endure so much. And that's what I was kind of on about. But at the same time, it's been, I got into a lot. I got into doing like a reformer Pilates a lot. I kind of went away from the, you know, the big heavy squats and the, you know, the big weight, because I just thought I need to work on the big muscles, A, but maybe trying to work on micro muscles as well and seeing if it all helps, and touch what it has. But, you know, it is like, you know, there's a difference between a surgeon, there's a difference between a coach who, you know, may on paper have everything, but if you're constantly learning and educating yourself, you're actually finding the, you know, the little one percenters that can improve the bigger picture. So it's an interesting thing, and it's pretty amazing what you said about the woman, that lady, you know, and it is one of those things in hindsight, if I dealt with this person 3 months ago, 6 months ago, the benefits of that. And something I've noticed, and I actually spoke to a physio about this, is like, you know what, now if I have an injury, I feel like that, I don't know if the injuries are heightened because of the trauma that the body's been through. So I don't know if that is actually true to an extent where, you know, you might have some minor tear or minor ligament issue, but you feel like it might be worse than what it actually is purely from what you've experienced. Does that make sense?
Or? Yes, 100% true. So there's different layers to the injury itself. Funny enough, I've just become quite used to having people with ACL injuries. Mm. I had a guy who was 6'4". He's up from Lancaster. He's an MMA fighter. Mm. Chris, his name is, so shout out to Chris. He actually knows the owner of the gym, Shea Walsh. He's an ex-fighter. Wow. Yeah. Good friends, best friends with Volkanovski.
Oh, so, amazing.
So they're all part of the same group of people. And Chris is not a small guy, 6'4", 6'5", but he has freakish athletic abilities. Mm. So we talked, the last, you know, the person I can probably compare him to, and it's a big statement to say this, but he moves just as freakishly, but Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, well.
In the UFC, yeah, a guy about that same size moves like a guy who's 5'4", being that size. Mm. So Chris is exactly the same, and he's got the same flexibility. So he can go, when I met him first, he was able to almost go fully into a full front split, almost into a full side split. And he didn't really do much flexibility training, but he had 100% tear on his ACL. Rolling, you know, doing pads and rolling around. So I remember when I was rehabbing him, it was just when lockdown, the second lockdown was just about to start. So the doctors literally told him, you need to go into surgery, but because of COVID, you're going to have to wait. So I said to Chris that let's go through the process of rehabbing it as much as possible. And then whenever the surgery happens, you might not even need it. You might decide that you don't want the surgery anymore. But if you do, then at least you can go over that hurdle. So we spent 6 months to about a year rehabbing it. And honest to God, Ollie, if you had met him before and I told you that he hadn't injured himself, and you just met the guy, you would not be able to tell he's torn his ACL.
No way
he was moving around after the rehab process was insane. And I remember seeing him through the rehab process. It was only one session a week because I was only going up to Lancaster once a week. And this guy could barely even bend that knee at one point. He was in crutches, he was on braces. Yeah. And then a few weeks later, he was not using the braces anymore. And then a few weeks later after that, he was doing, you know, some pretty impressive stuff. And I remember thinking to myself, there's different layers of this injury, going back to your question. The first one is the impact of the injury, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you've gone through the trauma of going through the injury. What you haven't fully understood, or if you're self-aware, you probably have, is the apprehension that is created. So we have this thing in the body called the apprehension reflex. It's something I learned from one of my mobility coaches. He's been in the game for a long time. And he talked about this idea of the apprehension reflex. So for example, if I say to you, and most people will understand where I'm coming from with this example. Mm. If I say to you, let's go to a splits class in, you know, like a, I don't know, Pilates gym or a gymnastics center. And the teacher tells us that before we even warm up, I want you to slide into a side split, a box split. The fact that you know you can't do it, and the fact that you know how uncomfortable it is to even get down to that depth, that is known as the apprehension reflex. So that kicks in straight away, telling you you can't do that movement. So then that stops you from sliding down straight away. Now, if I can override that apprehension reflex, then there's more, maybe you won't go down all the way, but you'll definitely get a much deeper experience than if I, you know, if you allowed it to kick in. So our goal when it comes to flexibility training is to overcome the mental issue, which is the traumatic experience, then the nervous experience, and then also the muscular, and then obviously if it's bone or tendon, then that as well. So there's different layers to rehabbing the body. So it's not just a physical process. They say tendons will recover, I think it takes 10 times as much time for a tendon to recover compared to a muscle. So a muscle will recover between 6 to 8 hours. A tendon will take between 70 to 80 hours of recovery.
Wow.
And if you've got an injury, it will probably take you at least 10 times as much longer to recover from it. And I remember through my own experiences of injuries in my elbow and messing that up, that it was a very similar process. But what does remain and what is the final key when it comes to tendon-related injuries is how much you get over the trauma.
Yeah.
So the way I've learned this is you have to almost mimic the same scenario that got you injured in the first place. So for you, the way you turned, and that's what tore your
ACL,
you have to almost create the same scenario, but as controlled as possible. And as soon as we do that, then the body will say, it'll flip a switch and say, you're fine now. But until then, you will still continue to experience that sensation on the side of your knee. Even if you think that it's 100% recovered 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line, that sensation will still remain until you mimic that same scenario.
Wow, that's amazing. Isn't it funny, that analogy then just popped in my head and it went, we can use that in life in a lot of ways. Like, regardless of injuries, regardless of, you know, adversities, fears, you know, bad experiences, do we reenact that in other ways to get past that next stepping stone, like that next obstacle in our life? Wow, that's pretty amazing shit. That's really just hit me then, woke me up a bit then with that. do you think as well, like, I found out of all of the grafts I've had, so I've had hamstring graft, I've had the half hamstring, I think it was, with a synthetic or fake, and Lars, and then the last one I had was patella. Patella by far is the best one I've had. I don't know what it is, but it's been the best. So anyone out there who's going through an ACL reconstruction right now, try and push for the patella, because it's been, for me, in my experience anyway, it's been the best. But it's pretty amazing, man. You're in depth, and obviously talking about it, you're very passionate about the whole body. And like you said, you've gone from one stage to another stage to another stage. And I think that's great, because we shouldn't pigeonhole ourselves. We shouldn't go, that's what we are, this is what we do. I think we constantly evolve.
Yeah, 100%. And it comes from a place of always wanting to evolve and always being a student. Because we do, and I think it is one of the issues with our industry, is we get too complacent when it comes to, for example, surgeons will get very complacent about where they are in terms of their practice, and they'll remain with the same ideas. So when you're talking about patella, using the patella construction, that's the perfect example. For many years, they'll use one method, switch over to another method in a very apprehensive way. Funnily enough, we're using that word, but in a very apprehensive way. But once there's enough studies done on it, they'll switch over. But there really isn't this this desire, unfortunately, in our industry to actually change as much as possible, try and get more ideas in and change with that. And I think this is one of the reasons why people like myself, and I don't know if you heard of the knees over toes guy. The reason why these people have become prominent is for this exact reason, where for a long period of time, and I remember when I first started training, that the idea was you should never get your knees beyond the line of your toes.
Correct.
And that's how they taught you. I trained a rugby player who was a good friend of mine in the gym years ago, and it was just one exercise I gave him, which it just blew his mind that I was giving him this exercise. So he had a squat, but he could only go to 90 degrees. He couldn't go any below than that. And at some point I said to him that, mate, you're going to 90 degrees with pretty heavy weight. You're going to slip a disc. And unfortunately, you know, a few months down the line, he came to me and he goes, he slipped a disc. So I said to him, what movement was it that you did? And he said he did a squat. And again, if you go into 90 degrees in a squat, you're probably extending through your back quite a lot. So I said to him, try this out. Before you train now, I want you to do Jeffson curls. I don't know if you've ever heard of a Jeffson curl. Imagine a really bad deadlift. So you round in the back, but it's all controlled and you're doing it with a lighter weight.
Oh, okay.
So that's a Jefferson curl. It's all known in the gymnastics industry because they are massively huge about that movement. for hamstring lengthening and also for posterior chain strength. So the problem is not the fact that your posture is poor. The problem is you're stuck with a particular movement. So your posture can be poor rounding
because
you're stuck 8 hours a day working a job like this, or your posture can be bad keeping it fully straight. And I've met that kind of person as well, but I'll go into that in a second. So this guy, I told him, all your movements are extending through the back, but it's hyperextension now because your hips are too tight and your low back won't allow you to get deep enough in your squat. So I said, just try these Jefferson curls out. Start of your session, 3 sets, 10 reps, nothing heavier than about 5 or 10 kg weight, and that's it. Mm. And he did it, and within a few months, he said straight away he felt a difference. He felt like even the first few sessions of doing it, like the nerves were just relaxing in his back.
Wow.
And I said, yeah, what you're doing is you're pushing the slip disc back into the opposite direction, which is what's caused it in the first place. You're extending through the back, so it's protruding inwards. So you want to push it back and force it back into its original position. So you do that by the opposite movement, which is the Jefferson curl. Mm. And this is the one thing I'm looking out for. When you have injuries or whatever things that have caused the issue, what movement have you done repeatedly? And what movement haven't you done? So if you're a boxer, I've just literally just trained a boxer lad who's going into a fight in 2 weeks' time. I'm looking at pattern overload. How much is he rotating his shoulder?
Yeah.
And that pattern overload is wearing away the joint and the tendons. So when it comes to those injuries that we're talking about, ACL injuries, MCL injuries, patella injuries, meniscus injuries, it's not necessarily that situation that's caused the injury. That's just the moment where the camel's, you know, broken his back.
Yeah, correct.
You've had that for a long period of time. You've just not paid attention to it. And it was just that moment that triggered it. Because you've done that movement where you've turned, stopped and turned enough times in the past.
Correct.
And you've not done anything. But this one moment, you do the same thing and you've actually injured yourself. So how far has that injury be, you know, how far has that injury come through the process of, for it to happen in that situation? Mm. So how long have you been sitting on the injury before it's happened?
Well, when I did the reconstruction, you asked me the last time. Well, it was 12 months before the previous surgery. So it's been 4 years now, but before that, 4 or 5 years now. But I mean, before that, there was like, I did my ACL, 12-month recovery, did my ACL again, like literally 3 months after. So I was thinking, you know, it's hard when they say the grafts take time. They say normally 12 months.
Right.
But I think, you know, it is more of a, like the whole body thing. Like you said, it's the camp, you know, the final straw that breaks the camel's back, you know. But it's something going on elsewhere, do you know what I mean? And it might be the chains, the way you move your hips, the way you sit. Probably the way I'm relaxed right now, sitting on an edge, it all plays an effect, you know, so... The body's unbelievable, so...
Yeah, 100%.
It's interesting, and there's a couple of other things I want to ask about, obviously, check with you, because you're very big on the body, mind, and spirit, as you say. So I've been doing a little bit of research on you. I can see you're very big into, like, spirituality, and...
Yeah.
It's something... What do you do on Fridays? I was asking Carl about it earlier.
On Fridays?
Do you work somewhere else?
Probably just go up to Lancaster on a Friday to train the guys there, but I think Cal's probably talking about I do a bit of community-based work for the local temple that I go to. It's a Hindu temple, and I'm very fortunate in that aspect where I've been brought up in a very spiritual family, where most people have been surrounded by interesting people in their regards, like successful people, business people. I've been surrounded by monks my entire life. So we've been given a different form of thinking and teaching, but it only comes into fruition when you're a lot older, because when you're young, you think, you know, these people are talking from a place of experience which isn't involved in the world. So they don't participate in any worldly affairs. They live in a temple, so it's almost safeguarded. But as I've grown older, I've realized that I've always been different to most people. Just in the way I think about things. And yeah, I think once you know, your whole life when you're younger is you're trying to fit in.
Oh, so true, yeah.
And then one day you realize that actually that's a pointless goal. You know, let me focus on what I am and try and hone in on that. And that's what everyone wants now, don't they? And when you go through the school system, they're trying to make you fit into the cog. But then as you get older, companies like Google, all the successful companies are looking for people that stand out.
Yeah.
It's like your entire life, you've taught me to become this part of this machine, and now you want me to act differently. So I'm just fortunate that the spiritual background has allowed me to act differently. And yeah, there's a lot of, I've come from a Hindu background, so there's a lot of meditation involved, but that is just scratching the surface, because it starts from the question of who are you? And the identity, you know, it's probably watered quite a lot now because of the rise of the yoga industry. And
it's just massive now, isn't it?
Yeah. And people are interested in self-awareness and mindfulness and whatnot. So the question of who are you is something that can be asked by someone who's a beggar. That can be asked by a person who's the most successful person on the planet. Now, the it doesn't matter what those experiences are. A beggar on the street might be going through his journey. A millionaire might be going through his journey.
Yeah.
But they go through the same struggle, which is that question of who am I really? In this situation where either I've got all the success in the world or I've got no success whatsoever, who the hell am I?
Yeah.
And society has pointed out what we are in the exterior. They've done that really well. So you and I, we both know we're men, but in this world now, there's a struggle between identities as well.
Massively.
But we know we're men. We know that we have certain things that we like and we dislike. The people around us are telling us who we are. But the problem here is, say if I knock you on the head really hard, and now you lose your memory and you're in hospital, and it's happened many a time.
Yeah.
You know, older people get that through dementia, but it can happen through just a knock on the head, a really heavy knock on the head. You forget, let's say 60% or 70% of who you are. So you end up waking up in this hospital bed. You've got these random strangers that once upon a time were your parents.
Yeah.
And now they're telling you that you're our son, you're Ollie, you're this and that, you're a rugby player. All those things go out the window because it's like, well, I don't know who I am. So what I would say to people is our entire life, we can say up till this moment, until we ask this question, is based on memory.
Mm.
And memory is a very finite thing. We know it deteriorates as we get older. We know it deteriorates through experiences. We hold on to certain traumas. We let go of other traumas. Yeah. So how can we use that as the main basis of identity?
Mm.
So if you move away from who we are in terms of what we look like and how we behave, and we ask the question of, is there something observing us behind all of these layers? And it's something I did as a young kid. And maybe it was through a traumatic experience of drowning that I had this reality where I just stopped associating myself as the person I looked in the mirror. I just thought, it can't be this. Because I remember one day when I was bored in temple, funny enough, I was I looked at my finger and I followed it all the way up, up to my nose. And I thought, I can get all the way up to about there, but I can't see what's behind that unless I've got something reflecting what I am.
Yeah,
so unless I've got a mirror, or unless I've got a reflection, or I've got something that reflects my image, I don't know what I look like really.
Yeah.
And if there wasn't mirrors, if there wasn't this thing that was that could reflect things, how do you know what we look like?
Yeah, wow.
So it all started from that question. I don't know if you've ever had those kind of experiences yourself.
Yeah, I definitely check with the who am I. I think, you know, I think it's a good thing to experience that, because it gives you that moment of awareness like you just mentioned, but you kind of start to look within. The Bakery, based in Halifax. If you are a chocolate cake fan just like me and love a top quality brew, then check out the amazing team on Copley Road and in the Peace Hall in Halifax. The Bakery. The customer service is amazing, but more importantly, the food is even better. I can guarantee you will leave with a smile on your face and a full stomach. Honestly, guys, the food there is to die for. If you are in the Halifax area, get yourself down to the Bakery on Copley Road and the Peace Hall. Customer service is amazing, but like I said, more importantly, if you have a chocolate sweet tooth like me and want your little fix, get down there, because the food, the treats, the chocolate, the breakfast, the lunches, everything is amazing. So check it out, guys. Then regarding who am I and we've all got to experience that, definitely. So when I did my third knee ACL 5 years ago, that was really it for me, and it was a real big crossroad as in identity, because from a young age, from my family's reflection on me and what I felt like I was to them, I was always the rugby person, and so I was always, from 7 years old, I was always the rugby person. And then when it ended, it was a real crisis, and I definitely spiraled a bit, because it was a bit of a loss of who I was, loss of purpose. And it was a really, really hard time for a long time. But then it actually was the best time, because I was like, who am I without who am I without that? And that was a time for me to go, like you said, the skin, like this is just basically a cloak, a coat or something that just covers us. But, you know, deep down in our core, who am I? And I think that's always been a self-discovery since then. And I think I go through my life now just doing things that I'm passionate about. But it makes my soul smile, if that makes sense. And I don't identify by the rugby player anymore. Like, I might play it, but it doesn't define me. You know, the podcast, this doesn't define me. I would love to think that I connect with you and you connect to me purely on meeting each other, the energy that's connected between us. And yeah, it's just, it's been a really interesting thing. And I kind of, because I've experienced that, and like you've had that, you know, that moment, who am I? You may see other people now that are very driven or very identified by something. And have you ever come across like an ex-army person or an ex-boxer or ex-sportsman, and they always talk about something? Oh, you're back when I was playing thingy, or yeah, I was this or I was that. And or an ex-sergeant, oh, that's an ex-sergeant over there. Well, no, who is that? That's John. No, that's Katie. That's, you know, Steph. Like, let's know them more on a deeper level than just identifying them by something. Because that's where a lot of people, I think, lose themselves when they have to retire from a sport, because they haven't done the work to know who they are. And yeah, I remember this one time. So when I was living in Australia, there was a monk house about, okay, 5 minutes from my house. So one Saturday they have this free day where you can go in and meditate. And at this stage, I was still curious. I was doing a bit of meditation, but I needed to know more about it. And I'm not even going to give it credit the way I display it. But I went in there and it was like 20 random people. Like everyone was there, was different. And it was beautiful though. And we sat there and the guy explained to us meditation, and the monk explained to us meditation. And it was really interesting. And just the thought processes, and we went for an hour. For me, an hour is a long time. Maybe an hour for you isn't, but a long time for someone who's a pretty novice person into meditation. Hours sitting there still, fighting not to fall asleep at times because you're just in and out. But it's really good. And I think for meditation, Chet, I've kind of gone into the mindset now of not what I'm going to get out of this, but more of like going with no expectation.
100%. And to be fair, an hour is a long time.
Yeah.
So even for me, sometimes it's very difficult to kind of, first of all, separate yourself from your thoughts. And then secondly, to be able to sit still. Mm. So we were just talking about, for most of the podcast, about movement and moving the body and how amazing the body is when it moves. Not many people talk about how amazing the body is when it is still. Mm. And I mean fully still. So that hour that you're talking about, you're probably still shuffling around, moving, yeah. You know, you're trying to get comfortable. See that, I find it fascinating how in today's world, we're so deeply engrossed with movement of the body and how longevity is a consequence of movement. But actually, longevity of the mind is created by stillness. So as the body wants to move, the mind wants to stay still. Now, we're doing the opposite. We're letting the mind go crazy, and then we're trying to allow the body to become still, and it's just not happening. So the whole point of this is the way meditation really works, and there's nothing too fanciful about meditation. Mm. What you're doing there is you're basically trying to not attach yourself to your thoughts and your whatever your processes are in the mind, and just become the observer and just see what's in there. That's one way of doing it. The way we were taught is through chanting. So now instead of moving away from not thinking at all, you're trying to focus on one point and just one thing, and that's it. And by doing that, you've got something to anchor onto.
Yeah.
Say if you were in the desert and you were walking on your own and you didn't see anything for miles, and you see something moving in the distance, your eyes will be fixated on that one object until you get closer to it. Because, you know, in that moment in time, you've not seen anything for a long period of time, and something has caught you in the distance, and you're not going to focus on anything else apart from that object. That's exactly what we want to do with when it comes to chanting meditation or japa meditation, as it's known as, where you're reciting a particular word over and over again.
Correct. That's what I was doing. I can't remember the word. It was we had to kind of, your aim was to try and visualize like a moon or a sun, but right. from the stomach, from out of the, I can't remember. Anyway, I'm going to, again. But yeah, amazing what you're saying, mate. It really is.
Yeah, so it's through that that we create stillness. And it's funny because they say when it comes to the practice of yoga, I know that a lot of modern day yoga is all about flowy sequences and this and that. That's not the true essence of yoga. That's one part of it. The actual reason why you're practicing those postures is not because you want to become good at those postures, it's because you want to be still in one posture. And I think the time they say that is true mastery is if you can stay in one particular posture, I think it's 3 hours and 24 minutes. That's when you've fully mastered it. And I mean full stillness.
Yeah.
So if you're sat cross-legged, you want to be sat in that position without moving any part of the body for 3 hours and 24 minutes. Wow. As you found out, an hour is tough as it is.
And I was fidgeting then for an hour. It's just like this all the time. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know what though? If I was to say I wanted something out of it, I think I'd like challenges, right? So I always love physical challenges, putting my body, trying to push it all the time. I think with the meditation for me, it was more about A, getting comfortable with the mind and getting comfortable with the mind and just being more aware in myself, like aware in emotions, aware in if I felt a certain way, I can sit with myself and give myself time to feel what that was instead of being so busy, like we say, movement, and just essentially running away from that feeling. And I think, you know, sitting there still for that long, a lot of crazy thoughts come in your head, and so a lot of random thoughts would come in, like some things I'd be like, what the heck, where did that come from? Or growing up really young and experiencing something then. But so, you know, when you talking about Chet, about, you know, who am I, and you said you experienced that the you're drowning, what was that journey like for you?
The process of drowning, or
the process of drowning, but more about when you started questioning yourself, like, who am I?
Right.
What was that bit of self-discovery like?
Well, like I said, we were fortunate that we had all the answers, but they were all answers on, you know, in scriptures and talks. But the monks were, you know, credit to them, they used to say just clearly to us that we can say who you are, but then you're never going to fully understand that until you fully experience it. So it's going through the experience of knowing who you are. And I remember it wasn't a massive struggle in the sense that I kept questioning who I was. It was just everything that was happening around me that was highlighting the fact that this is all just a bunch of roles that we're playing. You know, we're watching a movie. Once the movie's done, all the characters obviously return back to their actor form and they go into the green screen and everyone's friends. So the evil people are also just normal people. And it's that amazing story that's happening in front of us. Hinduism talks about this idea of lila, which is divine play by definition. And it's basically this concept of God playing this game of roles. And that's what we are. We're playing these roles. And it's experiencing each role. And as time goes on, we should be able to almost let go of those roles. So you might, Ollie, still be a rugby player, but now compared to where you were 5-6 years ago, there isn't this strong attachment towards that rugby player, that image of the rugby player. You are that rugby player, but there's a big part of you that knows that that's just a role I'm doing for an hour and a half a day, maybe 3 times a week of training as well, and that's it. But you've got other areas of exploration that you have on the side.
Right.
And that is our ultimate aim, is to try and find that distinction point and realize that actually, like you said at the start of this conversation, when we talked about the mind, we are basically clothes and we're just putting one piece of clothing on for another piece of clothing. And that's all we're doing. And until we get to that reality, life will become hard for us because all we're doing is we're going through the roller coaster of life. So when highs are really good, we get really excited. When it's really low, we get depressed. So that's why the temple you went to or the monastery you went to, you know, they're probably Buddhist monks or Hindu monks. Everyone is on about this level. So they're not up here and they're not down there. So we want to be on that level. And then we can deviate a bit. We can have a bit of fun and we can also have a bit of sadness. But it's also realizing that even though we're going through those experiences, they're still not us.
Wow. That's amazing. Episode is brought to you by Solid Directions Carpentry. Whether it's a door hanging, a deck building, a full renovation, they do it all in a timely and an efficient manner. working to a budget within your guidelines. They complement the look of your home in a matter of weeks. Then check out the team at Solid Erections Carpentry, who are based in Brisbane.
Another thing as well, reading this book, you probably know him, he's pretty mainstream now, is that Jay Shetty, and he did 3 years of being a monk. And he was talking about how, you know, people picture monks as, you know, like these people who are very still. And he said when he became, trying to become a monk, he said, you know, we're all human. For instance, you know, if when we were meditating, he'd say, you know, someone would fall asleep or you hear someone snore. And he's like, instantly, everyone as like a junior would look up and like, what the heck? You know, like judge without meaning to judge. But the main, you know, the head monks would kind of laugh at them, kind of saying, you know, we all are not perfect as such. And, you know, he might fall asleep there, but you might do something else. And, you know, give or take, and kind of it's about letting go of that emotion and that feeling. And that's probably one thing as well. I think, you know, reflecting on that, you know, learning not to judge, like learning that, like preventing gossip. And that's quite big in the westernized country is gossip, because it makes us feel better. You know, putting someone else's candle out won't make our candle any brighter. But learning that, and I think, you know, it's just kind of, that was probably the biggest thing for me. I wanted to be more aware of, I'd rather hype you up and tell you how well you're going than actually talk smack behind your back. And I think that's something I'm really aware of, and I've distanced myself from all of that. But, you know, they say as well, you know, you are who you hang around with. You know, you are the five people you surround yourself with. Do you think that's the same concept then? You know, if you were doing all of this work on yourself, but if I chuck you in a pool of people who are all negative people or druggies or alcoholics, whatever, do you think if you did all that work that there's a part of you that would be wanting to do that? Or do you think that you could go, no, I'm still myself, if that makes sense?
And again, it goes into the question of who you are,
yeah.
As in, what is that myself? But no, in the layman's term, when it comes to that question, the answer is no, because there's a difference between judgment and discrimination. Now, judgment, we already know the negative connotations attached to judgment, right? As you described, yeah. You don't want to label someone doing something and then judge them for that. But you are allowed to discriminate, which is unusual, because in this world, this day and age, discrimination has caused where we are in society, yeah. Right? But the true discrimination here is you should be able to observe whatever negative traits you see in me, both positive and negative. The only difference here is you don't take those negative traits, because as soon as you take those negative traits, they become a part of you. You take my positive traits through your discrimination, but you don't take the negative ones. And it's the same for every other person you see on the planet. So when I'm with those five people that you're saying, I will look at them, I will discriminate and say, say it to myself, I won't say it out loud, but I'll know what their negative traits are. A fool is anyone who can't see that.
Mm.
That's why you get situations where kids are vulnerable, they get pulled into paedophile situations because they don't know any different to that person who's giving you a candy compared to another person who's doing it out of good intention. So a child can't discriminate that well because they don't know the world. Correct. We can. So discrimination isn't a negative thing. The problem is when the discrimination becomes a part of you, you take their negative traits. So the best way I would say is, you know, we can decipher when it's a negative discrimination. So how do you take it when it's a positive discrimination? So I look at you and think, okay, you've gone through a number of surgeries and you're still very optimistic about life. You're not so clingy towards your rugby life. So that is a very positive thing. I should take those 100% and then allow that to be a part of me. And the way I do that is I either adapt it to my life and have that sort of mentality, or I speak highly of you based on that. When I do take it negatively is when I speak negatively of you. Soon as I've taken the judgment, oh, this guy's a bit weird because he's done this, and then I speak to other people about you in that negative way, then I've become discriminatory in a negative way. So as long as we are aware of those two things, this flowing through life becomes a lot easier and more pleasant. And we're not going against the tide, we're going with the tide. And I think that's the way I would address a situation where you're with people that are going through their own struggles. Because at the end of the day, you understand that you've gone through your struggles. These people are just on a different level and they're going through a different set of struggles.
That's cool, Chet. So again, then, for people out there who are, you know, working the 9 to 5 or in a business or maybe working with self-employed. And then, if business is quiet or, they start to stress, money isn't coming in. How do we connect it to them where we don't get overwhelmed about what's ahead, but we can only do what's in our control?
Right. So I think if you've read Jay Shetty's book, I think it quotes the Bhagavad Gita quite a lot. Mm. And Krishna, the incarnation of God, says in the Gita that you only have a right to the action itself, not the fruits of your action. Mm. So whatever decision you make in this moment in time, regardless of the scenario, so you're trying to run this business, right? And you're not getting the positive benefits of that business. People are not coming to you. Mm. You're not making money. You don't have a right to that. The only thing you have a right to is that action. Mm. So he says in the Gita that you dedicate those actions to me and let me take care of the fruits. Mm. Whether you gain the fruits or not is my choice. And we've got the process of karma. In the Western sense, karma is anything negative that happens to you. Mm. In the Eastern sense, it's everything. So both positive and negative. So if I push you over down the stairs, at some point that's going to come back to bite me in the ass.
Yeah.
But also if I do something positive for you, that will also come back to me as well. And there's different layers to that. So if the positivity comes from a space of it's making me feel good, again, there's a level of selfishness towards the action. Mm. So let's say you give to charity, right?
Yeah.
And you give £20 to a homeless person. But 9 times out of 10, that guy's going to be over the moon. He's going to be thankful to you. Let's say one time you give it to someone and he's not in a good mood and he thinks that you're looking down on him, and now he starts to swear at you and he starts to push you around. When you walk away from that scenario, if it makes you feel, I'm never going to do that again, or why am I going through this process? He should be grateful that I gave him money.
Mm.
And that is the selfish part of the action.
Wow.
So a lot of philanthropy in the world, a lot of people give. Philanthropy in itself is giving, so then you get the accolades of giving. So you've got how many people would give if people were able to see what they gave?
Correct.
So how many people give as an unknown source? And there are people, there are people out there who do that. Those people are, again, when it comes to the level of fruits coming back to them, they're on a different level. They'll get their fruits, whether they do get their fruits or they don't get their fruits, they're not too bothered.
Mm.
It's just through purely the action of giving. That's their sort of gratification.
Yeah.
That's
amazing. That one hit at the end. Just doing things without any expectation or anything in return, and doing it just for the goodness, without looking good for other people. Because like you said, there's a lot of people that do that out there. With yourself, Chet. Obviously we've been talking more about a bit about your journey, I suppose, but your teachings and what you've learned, and do you implement that into your clients then as well?
I think it just kind of leaks out.
Yeah. Well, you're just being yourself, right?
Yeah.
So again, you can't not change who you are. That you are who you are.
Yeah. And whatever they take. Yeah. I'm not there to, as soon as you come to me, I'm not here to preach to you about the Gita and say this is how you're supposed to do it. But I'm there to kind of give you different perspectives of life. And you'll find every single person that comes to you, it's not a coincidence that they come to you, regardless of whether it's a 3-second encounter on the street or it's a 10-hour encounter that ends up leading to a deep friendship. They've come to you because in a previous lifetime, you've met each other. Correct. And you've gone through the process. Because you've probably been in a scenario where you've met someone and you've just hit it off straight away. And it's just like, it feels like we've been friends for a long time.
Yeah.
So there's also reasons for that. Whatever life has done, you've led to that moment to meet that person again. And you want to give them the best you possibly can. So as long as I'm training people in the best possible way that I feel like is the right way, then really, you can't really go wrong, right? And if the person feels like this guy's a weirdo, no problem.
That's not on you.
That's not on me.
Yeah, that's just the way, that's their perception. And that's another thing, coming back to being comfortable with who you are. I think, if you're not trying to be someone, I think people levitate towards you anyway because you're being authentically yourself.
Mm.
That's one thing. I got it comfortable with the stage of going, it's okay to be myself. And the more, not weird, but the more I was different to others, the more I was comfortable in who I was.
Yeah.
Does that come with age, do you think? Or does it, like when you're young, you're trying to fit in, like you said, you're trying to be accepted. You've come, communities are based, and we've got this hierarchy in our culture of where we sit on that, and And if the cool guy's doing that, we normally want to tend to do what the cool guy's doing, right? So,
yeah, it definitely does come with age. I think there's an old saying that says, youth is wasted on the young. Because when you're young, you're making these stupid mistakes. And through those mistakes, that's when wisdom arises. Mm-hmm. But you can't have wisdom unless you go through those processes. But yeah, it's interesting what you said about how we look up at people. I feel like the role models that we have, the idea of role models is great, but like we said about the discrimination thing, when I'm choosing a role model, I want to discriminate and only pick the factors that are going to benefit me. So if someone says, why do you follow this guy? Or, you know, he's a bit of a jerk like this and that. I think the most common person at the moment that became quite famous through all this was, what's he called? The ball guy. I forgot his name.
Joe Rogan.
No. It was all over social media.
Oh, Andrew Tate.
I don't know how I forgot his name. But a lot of the things he was saying for me, someone asked me about how I felt towards him. Mm. And originally there was a bit of a defensiveness and thought, you know, he's spitting a lot of stuff. But then I looked at it deeper, and I would say about 10% of the things he's saying is true, but it's clouded with a lot of 90% of selling.
Mm.
When you sell things, then it becomes a problem. Especially when you sell something that isn't in line with what you're trying to say in the first place. Mm. Then you kind of see the cracks, and that's when people start to hate you a bit more. But even with Andrew Tate, you can take certain positive things out of what he's saying. Because obviously, he's benefited a lot of guys. So we shouldn't be shying away from these kind of things. But at the same time, you should know what you can't take, what you shouldn't take. And I think that's where we fall short, where we look at role models. These days, most people's role models are celebrities. And I don't really listen to modern Western music anyway, because it's all about drugs, violence, sex, and that kind of stuff. And if you're fueling that for your ears, you know, that's how your brain's going to think. So if you're wondering why you can't sit still and meditate, it's because you've got drugs, violence, sex in your head and making money. So it's the conditioning that happens behind the scenes that you don't realize. Mm. And it goes further into... Once you start to realize these conditioning tools are there, we can start looking at what we're eating.
Yeah.
Who's the person who's made our food? You know, these kind of things. Mm. What are the ingredients going into our food? And then we start to realize, actually, this whole process in life is there to distract us.
Yeah.
Purely distract us in any form possible. So how do we first recognize that they are distractions? And how do we then learn to manage or control these distractions? Mm.
That's true. Manage the distractions, yeah. Again, it comes back to checking. I think for me, it's more checking in with myself. And is that value aligned with me? I want to ask you something. What's your biggest fear?
I think the fear of not achieving God. I mean, that is probably the biggest fear. I don't have a fear of dying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty much ready to go whenever. You know, I don't have any issues. It's the fear of letting God down. And obviously, a lot of people have different connotations attached to God. But for me, the process of going through this journey and falling short, just like any goal you go through, you know, you don't want to fall short.
Of course.
And this is probably the most fear I have. Mm. But if you think about my fear, if my fear is fearing that I can't achieve God, compared to someone who's barely making any money, who's, you know, scratching through life, it's not really that big deal for most people. But yeah, I would say that's probably my biggest fear.
Do you think, you know, failing God, is that like as in trying to be not perfect, but just aligning with God? Or does that mean, you know, everything you're doing, like what you're doing now, daily practices and with work, with clients and your connection? Like,
yeah.
It's a hard, not a hard, but it's, if it was easy, everyone would do it, right?
Yeah. It's the transparency. Mm. So every single thing I'm saying in this podcast, if I can't implement one thing, so all the stuff I've said, if I'm just saying this to you just to make your viewers think I'm someone special or whatever, or to you to make you feel like this guy's different, then I'm failing there. Okay. Everything that I'm saying has to be implemented. Mm. Everything. And yeah, there's going to be times where I slip up and anger might seep out or this and that. But there has to be this overall progression through life where every time, every year I look back and I think, wow, I was that kind of person. You know, it's crazy how much I've changed. If that process stops, I'm failing God.
Mm.
So as long as you keep continuously evolving as a human being, and you're doing things purely for the act of things that are in alignment with what's right for you. So if I'm, say I'm training you, right? And I know your background, I think this guy's got some money and now I'm going to charge you a bit more money.
Check him. Yeah, yeah.
And then I charge someone else less because I feel like, oh, they're not that financially off. But then when I look at the two of those situations and I think, wait a second, look, I've charged this guy based on his financial circumstances. Instead of staying with one constant price that I feel is right, I've decided to pick one over the other and almost like benefit from you because you're making more money, so I can charge you more. Then I'm failing myself.
Yes. That's a hard one though, because then does that come down to like not pleasing, but you're trying to please your clientele, like that guy who might not financially be there, but you know he would benefit from that. It's like that, you know, you're trying to do a goodness part there, or at the same time you're kind of going against your values again, because you should treat him exactly the same as the guy as long as he's coming to you, or that woman, sorry.
Yeah.
When it comes as well to you, Chet, with, for instance, frustration, you know, when your biggest fear is, it's not, you know, living up to, you know, up to God or failing God. That's not a high expectation, but it's a challenge. If you feel like you've let him down one day, or reflecting, go, you know, you dwell on stuff, how long do you let that hold you for?
Well, that's the key. Mm. So if I'm holding on to that for too long, I'm wasting my time holding on to that for too long. So that's right. When I'm failing. So that you'll know straight away when you're holding on to things, there's a guilty feeling inside of you saying you've done something wrong. So going back to that scenario, if I'm charging that person a little less money because he's struggling, and then the intention is to try and bring him up and get him to a level, I can't now turn around and feel angry, disappointed, whatever you want to call it, if he's not doing the work.
Mm.
If from that, I feel like I'm doing you a service. We're going back to that homeless person scenario again, where you've given that person a bit of money and they've turned around and thrown it back in your face and shouted at you. I can't feel salty about that and feel, well, I'm doing you something. So then again, I'm using my ego.
Mm.
I'm throwing my ego around saying, well, I've just done you a favor. You should do something. You should at least meet that favor. That's when I'm failing.
Mm. What's your proudest moment?
To be fair, I would say it's probably an oxymoron, but the proudest moment is to not be proud.
Wow. Yeah.
So if you give me a compliment and that compliments make me feel good about myself, then that's pride.
That's pride.
That's pride. And I think when we look at, I think in all forms of religion and spiritual doctrines, pride is what takes us down as well. Mm. So to a certain degree, it's great, but I don't think I hope I don't do it. I hope that I don't get myself into a scenario where when someone says something or someone does something that is quite, catches me off guard, that I feel really good about it. Like, you know, it's fine to take it in as a compliment. So if someone says you've got great hair or whatever, take it as a compliment because they're giving you something. You shouldn't reject something. But if now that makes me inflate my ego and think, oh, actually, I must be something then.
You think it's... But if it's coming from a place of just, like you said, generally, like, okay, Chet, you're a great coach.
Yeah.
Obviously, surely we like, you know, we need some form of, you know, not support, I suppose. You know, someone to tell you're doing well. Sometimes I think sometimes we do need that bit of a tap on the back. You know, without our egos getting too caught up in it. You know, that's from my perspective anyway, you know. If you're ever doing a journey, on a journey of trying to take a new road, a new path, you never had that path vision out. I suppose when you've got God in your life, you know, God's guiding you the way as well. But, you know, I think, kind of contradict myself then with what I'm saying. But I just think we do need sometimes a form of, well done, you know, pat on the back, you're doing a great job. And just might give you that extra bit of energy that guy might or that girl might not have that day, that she might be questioning your journey right now.
Yeah, no, I don't take that away from anyone else. Mm. This is just when you asked me the question. Correct.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
And I understand that people need that as well. But from where I am with my journey, like I said, it's not wrong for that person to give you the compliment, and it's not wrong for you to accept it, because you should accept it. You should accept every single thing that anyone offers you as a compliment or whatever. But It's if that compliment later leads to some form of self-flattery. So now you're feeling like, wait a second, maybe this person is right about me. Maybe I am that great. And that will always happen. It will always happen. So when people say, well, what's wrong with me feeling great about myself about a tiny thing? Nothing wrong with that. It's the same as what's wrong with you eating junk food once or twice here and there. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. It's when that junk food starts to become a constant theme.
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
So that's when there's an issue.
Yeah.
So at all points, once you get to a certain stage in life, you've received enough compliments in your life.
Yeah.
You're good. You don't need any more.
You've capped out.
You've capped out.
You know, it's quite interesting because at the moment, right, I'm doing this challenge with part of our program. And on the challenges, you know, you got to stick to a diet plan for 75 days. But for the last 15 days now, so I was paleo. I've been going paleo for the last 55 days. But the last 20 days, sorry, I wanted to go carnivore. But I have a really bad sugar tooth. Like, I love sugar. But I wanted to challenge myself and go, you know, what am I without those, you know, like those feel-good factors and, you know, get all those things away and just kind of channel myself and test myself. Don't necessarily want to do carnival forever, but I mean, just for this day, just for those 20 days, just to know who I am as a person. And some people might go that, hey, you're crazy, but I'm okay being crazy to them because I just want to know, I suppose I want to know how far I can push myself in certain ways. And I think you would do the same, wouldn't you? And, you know, and I just think it's interesting, you know, people do fasting for, you know, for days, weeks on end, yeah, with just water fasts. And part of it is to just see how they can push themselves and what their body can endure.
100%. So we spoke briefly about it at the start of the podcast, about this idea of pushing the body. And there's an addiction or there's a curiosity to do that. Now, there is absolutely every need to do that because you're discovering different parts of who you are. And I think it all adds up to this idea of recognizing who you are in the deeper sense. So if you're not this body and you know that you can go without certain types of food, then clearly that can't be the defining factor of who you are. So the sugars that you're addicted to can't be the defining factor. Mm. So you're trying to overcome that struggle. Monks do the same thing. Their level of fast will probably just blow your mind, like the kind of stuff they fast on. Because I've known a monk who hasn't eaten any food for 35 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, just water, yeah.
How?
Yeah, these kind of things, it's very difficult because science hasn't caught up on these practices yet. But it is. As time is going on, science is catching up on it. But yeah, you know, these 5,000-year-old teachings, they were known as yogic sciences for a reason because these people did exactly what you're doing right now, which is, I want to experiment with this thing and see what happens. And they've gone really far with it. Yeah, there's a few, actually. It sounds impressive, but there's quite a few monks that... I just met a monk recently who doesn't sleep lying down at all. So for how many years? Probably about 25 years, 30 years, he hasn't slept lying down. He sits upright. So he doesn't really sleep, just stays upright. Yeah, so this austerities that people want to experience, for example, David Goggins talks about the type of experiences that you should go through and never being comfortable. The monks have that at a different level.
That's an uncomfortable, more in the mind though, like, you know, not a physical, but a more of a mental. Well, it is a bit of everything, but it's crazy that the body can do that because we're taught, you know, have 4 meals a day, make sure you eat your breakfast, this, that, and the other. And then I feel like sometimes monks, I know they don't laugh, but I bet a part of them goes, these guys are thinking this is new modern news, but it's been happening for years, you know? And
yeah. Yeah, there's the stuff that I've seen and experienced in my life would blow a lot of your viewers' minds. Mm. I've seen a monk, well, his guru was a monk who lived for 170 years. But then obviously modern day science says the oldest person on the planet was 120 something, right? Or something like that. There's actually currently a monk in India who's 125, 26, 27 years old. Fully well, he's got a certificate of when he was born. He was born in the late 1800s. And yeah, he just looks like a 70-year-old man. Because he's keeping his body well, but it's also the mind as well. How much stress are you going through in the mind? Whereas he, you know, he keeps his stress levels nice and low. But I think any feat is possible so long as you've got the right mentality, as you know, it's a cliche, but the right mentality, but also the right people around you as well, or no one. Either you have people around you that have got the same goal as you, or you have no one. Mm. Because at the end of the day, when you have people telling you that four meals a day is what you're supposed to eat or this and that, then subconsciously, as we said, but with music, it's going to put ideas into your mind that this is how it's supposed to be. So when you're feeling feelings and emotions in the body because of a lack of something in your body, a lot of the doubts behind those emotions and feelings is because of what people have told you, not what the actual experience is itself. How do you know what's anxiety unless someone's told you what anxiety is?
Of course, yeah, yeah. No one, like, no one, we've got that feeling and someone's just labeled it or someone's told you it. I quote me if I'm wrong, but I feel like anxiety is a part of the body telling you you need change.
Yeah. I mean, it's a primitive primitive feeling.
It doesn't like what it's going through right now. Something needs to change.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. If you go back to the primal days of cavemen, so let's say you're going through the jungle hunting for something, right? And again, 9 times out of 10, you see the ruffling of some grass and it makes you stop for a second. But 9 times out of 10, it's nothing. It's just the wind. Yeah. So you're fine. That one time, let's say a tiger pounces at you and you just about survive. So then when you go back to that scenario again, that feeling you get, the anxiety you get, is for that exact reason. It's so then you're making sure you don't put yourself in that scenario again. So that's when we're talking about change. It's because you're doing something that your body's not aligning with or doesn't enjoy, but yet you're still continuing to go through it without really thinking about what is the deeper reason for this experience and this feeling.
And that comes then if you connect that then with injuries.
Yes. Yeah.
Going back and doing that same movement again, that anxiety you get pre-movement.
Yeah.
You do it and that relief. Oh.
100%. Like if you've ever been scared of a dog or an animal, once you come across the animal and you experience it right in front of you and you realize actually it's just a tame animal and it's not going to hurt me, then immediately within a blink of the eye, the anxiety, the feeling, the horrible trauma disappears because you realize that actually in reality, this animal is not what I built it up to be.
Yes.
So that's a good example of the relationship between trauma and trauma manifesting into anxiety. Mm.
I love that, Chet. Well, Chet, mate, I don't want to be rude. We're going to have to wrap this up shortly, but mate, it's been a pleasure having you on, and this is not going to be the first one with you, mate. I've loved this conversation, and I feel like we're just scratching the surface at the moment. But what I ask every time when I finish up an episode is just, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for being given this opportunity to actually experience life in where I am right now, to meet the people I'm meeting, through interactions, through physical interactions, but also through conversations like we're having here. And this is probably the best time to be alive on the planet. And as much as all the stuff that's going on around us is chaos, it's allowing us to highlight what should be right and wrong within us. Yeah. So right and wrong for us is all subjective. But for now, you know straight away what is right for you more than any time in history. We live in very relatively peaceful times compared to the rest of history. So we have a great opportunity to look at the world and think, what is it that's wrong about the world? What is it that's right about the world? And what is it that I'm doing that's wrong and right about my actions towards the world? And I think that's my greatest form of gratitude. The fact that I can be here right now talking to you, and God knows how many people are listening. Mm. And maybe, you know, a few words will probably strike someone. Massively. And it'll help them out. So yeah, that's my thing.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much. I'm actually going to hit up a couple of my friends who have got some post injuries, knee problems. So I'm going to pass them your way and hopefully get them down to the performance space and do some work here. But thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you.
Don't just talk it, walk it.
Walk is only.
Don't just talk it, walk it. Don't just talk it, walk it.
Walk is only.
Don't just talk it, walk it.
Walk is only.